Asia-Pacific currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia-Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia-Asia Worker Link. Good morning and welcome to another episode of Asia Pacific Currents here on Community Radio 3CR. I'm Giselle Hanna.
And I'm James Barry.
We're taking you through to 9:30 this morning. Of course, Asia Pacific Currents is brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. You can find us on the web, all the ws.aawl.org.au. We have a really long interview today, so sit back and listen, as promised, Joseph Dyherd about the war in the Middle East. Joe is an academic based in Switzerland, and he is an internationalist, and he is a general progressive. Here is that interview.
Definitely, I think we have to understand the latest war led by the US and Israel within the context of the post 7th October 2023. In other words, a process to try to consolidate US hegemony, imperial hegemony in the region of the Middle East and North Africa, in which Israel has been playing a key role to consolidate this U.S. imperial hegemony. And I think in this perspective, we should always remember that the one giving the orders is the U.S. imperialist power, and Israel as acting as its main ally in the region. And in this perspective, following the 7th of October, we witnessed the ongoing, unfortunately, genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza, the expansion of the occupation in the West Bank, but also, and as clearly showing more and more that the operation of the 7th of October was only a pretext for Israel to widen and to fulfill its settler colonial project seeking the elimination of the Palestinians, but as well to serve and fulfill U.S. imperialist interests. We've seen the in the process of the genocide, the Israel expanded its war to Lebanon in 2024, especially during 3 months from September to November. And despite the ceasefire that was concluded in the end of November, Israel continued its war against the Lebanese population, especially in the south and the Bekaa, eastern Lebanon, but also widened its occupation of Syria following the fall of the Assad regime and trying to exploit sectarian differences, create more instability within Syria. This is not to say, and we'll come back maybe to this later, that the same government with its sectarian policies, oppressive policies against sectors of the population, give the space to Israel to exploit this these sectarian tensions. And without forgetting the U.S.-Israeli war of 2025 against Iran. So it's clearly we're seeing the latest war against Iran, the Israeli war against Lebanon, as a continuous attempt to consolidate U.S. imperial hegemony in the region of the Middle East, which is absolutely key within the process of international capital accumulation because of the concentration of gas and oil, which is at the center until today of our international political economy and capital accumulation.
We're going to get into those themes in a bit more detail, the possibility of the permanent occupation of Lebanon and also the situation with oil. I still want to talk, I just want to look a little bit further at the issue of imperialist powers across the world. And again, looking at the international commentary, there's some talk about the emergence of this idea of a multipolar world with Russia and China supposedly balancing US power. In the Middle Eastern context, do you see Russia and China acting as counterweights to Western imperialism, or are they also pursuing their own forms of great power competition within global capitalism?
Yes, indeed, this is another very good question. I think we entered in the past decade or so, especially from the end of the 2000s, in a form of multipolar world, but this does not mean that the US is not the leading and most dangerous imperialist power in the world, but there's definitely a change or an evolution compared to the following the 90s, the end of the 80s, I would say, following the end of the Soviet Union, and this what has been characterized as a unipolar period with U.S. imperial power widening massively and in importance, political, economic, military importance. This is when in the 90s, the U.S. reestablished significant numbers of military establishment in the Middle East and North Africa. And the 2000s saw a relative weakening of this U.S. imperialism because, first of all, of the failures of its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, especially the economic financial crisis of 2008, and also the process or the beginning of the eruption of the refugee processes in the Middle East and North Africa. So I would say, yes, we entered a period where you have multiple imperialist poles in which Russia and China are, but they don't reach until now the imperialist, if you want, violence of the US, because the US has several decades or even more of advance in terms of imperial military power, which we're witnessing every day, I would say, in the Middle East and in a very much deepened and profound way since October 2023. So this said, again, I think we should, yes, indeed, looking at this and saying again that the US is the most, barbarian, violent kind of imperial power as we are seeing it. And again, we cannot understand the genocide in the Gaza Strip without the support, participation of the US in terms of military financial aid, political support, etc. Israel is the implementer, but the US is basically the imperial power allowing this to happen. If it would cut its financial assistance, its military assistance to Israel, this genocide would not happen. Now, when it comes to Russia, we shouldn't forget its role when it came to the Syrian uprising. It had a foreign intervention directly in Syria to assist and to help for the Assad regime to remain in power for several years. And its weakening, as well as the weakening of Iran, also allowed for the failure and the fall, finally, of the Assad regime in the end of December 2024. When it comes to China, its economic importance has expanded in the past two decades, China becoming, the main consumer of fuel oil derivatives from the Gulf monarchies, but also becoming the most important trade partner with Israel. And China wants to basically develop good relationship with both the Gulf monarchies and Israel, and this is also how we understand its relative, absence of actions within the Middle East, alongside other reasons, clearly enough. But they don't match whether Russia or China, kind of the U.S. Military capacities, and the Middle East remain very much, the zone of influence of the U.S. for the reasons I mentioned before, because of the concentration of oil and gas and its importance within international capital accumulation and international political economy. So the U.S. remained in the Middle East the key and most hegemonic imperial power, despite its relative weakening in the past two decades.
Let's talk about the importance of oil and the distribution of global oil resources. And of course, I want to look at the significance of the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, Iran has threatened to attack or set alight any ships carrying oil through the Strait. We know that they've been dropping mines as well. The US is trying to prevent the dropping of mines in the Strait. It has more or less been closed entirely. How much does this choke a significant portion of global oil supply, and what impact does that have on a political economic situation that is being created by the attack on Iran?
No, and here regarding the question, I think we can see directly the difference in objectives when it comes to the US and Israel regarding the latest war against Iran. The US have clearly said that they wanted a change of behavior of the Iranian regime and not to change the regime, whereas Israel is seeking much more a change of regime, creating chaos and maybe replacing the regime with, for example, the Shah of Iran, bringing back the monarchy that was very much allied with Israel. The US kind of logic is to say we wanted a short war, following kind of the example where I think the big mistake was made is that following the Venezuelan case, we would find someone quite fast within the regime, basically to serve our interests. The Iranian regime is very much different in many aspects of the Venezuelan state, much more ideological, but also much more controlled by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Therefore, the war has been, you know, is lasting, and this is also one of the objectives of the Iranian state, the Iranian regime, to remain in power, to have a prolonged multiple war fronts in order to make the war last, and also to make it pay economically for the US. And here the oil importance, the oil issue is very much important. We've seen through the Strait of Hormuz more than 20% of transfer oil worldly goes through. We also already seen the prices of oil reaching around $100. The instability of the fact that the war will mostly last has already impacted, you know, prices not only in the region of the Middle East, but already partially in Europe and the US, creating inflation dynamics. And therefore, the issue for the US is to try to not make this war go on too long, because this will have political consequences, especially for Donald Trump. The midterms are coming. He doesn't want to see more inflation dynamics within the US. And therefore, again, we can see the importance and significance of oil in the international political economy. We have to understand that any change of power within the Middle East can have a strong influence in the dynamics of capital accumulation within the world. And this has been the case since the Second World War, when oil became the main energy resource in the world instead of charcoal. And this is how we understand the way also US and its importance of the Middle East. It opposed first in the 50s, 60s, any kind of political current or regime that challenged US imperial power and wanted to maintain, you know, conservative regimes, pro-Western regime that would not challenge the dynamics of capital accumulation around all derivatives that favored, you know, Western economy, US economy. And today, any kind of changes within the Gulf monarchies or elsewhere would affect, you know, US imperial hegemony. And therefore, you know, challenging the Islamic Republic of Iran that basically does not follow like the Gulf monarchies or US imperial hegemony is, you know, creating this kind of instability. But again, I think the key importance of the US is today, and as also Trump has mentioned in a couple of occasions, they want to find someone from the inside to have a change of behavior of the regime, and it's not at all intervening and needing this war in Iran for the sake of the Iranian population or for the democratization of Iran. They just want an Iran that respects U.S. imperial hegemony, that follows basically the rules.
Let's look a little bit more at Israel for a moment. And I want to talk about its current attack on Lebanon, again, displacing 750,000 Lebanese. I mean, nobody's calling that ethnic cleansing. I haven't seen anyone call it. It's clearly what it is, moving almost a million people out of the southern region of Lebanon. Firstly, do you think Israel's broader objective simply is to forever occupy the southern border region of Lebanon? And given your work on Hezbollah and the Lebanese political economy, how should the left understand these dynamics?
Yeah, so there's a couple levels to your question. First of all, I think we have to understand Israel's latest war in the continuation of 7 of October of creating a region completely submitted to the US Israel hegemony. And the, as you were saying, the massive displacement of population in Lebanon by the latest Israeli war, but the current Israeli war is also in the has several objectives and the massive killing that is occurring as well. And when it comes, I think, and I believe that one of the objectives in the south of Israel is to create a so-called buffer zone, expanding, no man's basically land, like we are seeing in the Gaza Strip, where large portion of lands of the Gaza Strip have been completely evacuated forcefully of its population. And the population of Gaza is mostly concentrated only 50% of the whole territory. So it's to expand also the so-called buffer zone for so-called security defense, but more security interests. We've seen also the expansion of buffer zones within the south of Syria, but not at the scale of what we witnessed in South Lebanon. So there's a direct threat that the whole south of the Litani be completely void of Lebanese population or population within Lebanon. We already seen in the year in 2024, large areas of southern Lebanon completely destroyed and were prevented of any attempts of reconstruction by the Israeli apartheid state. If we look back at history, there's always been, within the Zionist movement, even before the establishment of Israel, interest of taking these lands south of the Litani. What is clear today is really expanding its buffer zone. What are the objectives of the Israeli apartheid colonial state in Lebanon? First of all, is to weaken significantly and possibly try to, completely, I wouldn't say ability to destroy, but at least seeking to destroy massively or to weaken significantly Hezbollah, militarily, politically, economically. Also to create by the massive bombings, especially Shia populated areas, a gap or frustration from Shia popular bases that is already, very much tired, frustrated of the past 2 years of wars, that for a section of them have not been able to go back to their towns and villages in the south, to create, a gap, political gap between Hezbollah and its popular base. And we witness forms of frustration towards it. But it's also the Israeli objective is to create sectarian tensions within Lebanon that have been maturing because of the sectarian system in Lebanon, but also because of policies of Hezbollah. And I'll come back to this later on. To push also the Lebanese government to act against Hezbollah, and the Lebanese government has already made a decision to make Hezbollah military branch illegal and any kind of action of Hezbollah illegal as well, and to push the Lebanese government to go forward with the disarmament process relative to Hezbollah that started at the beginning of 2025. This Lebanese government is very much under pressure, but also following kind of orders of the US, Western countries, but also Gulf monarchies that are pressuring the government to disarm Hezbollah. And actually, the funding of the Lebanese army is dependent mostly on this objective of disarmament of Hezbollah and not at all seeking the protection of the Lebanese population, its borders, etc., which is very problematic for a Lebanese government claiming to act for the sovereignty of for Lebanon and its people, etc. At the same time, they want to push this Lebanese government towards normalization with the Israeli state by, continuously bombing, etc., trying to push them to normalize. And actually, Lebanese government has said that it's ready to have very much open negotiation with Israel, even at civilian level, ministerial level. But Israel, for example, for the moment, has refused to continue its war. Also, Israel has, taken the opportunity to attack other actors than Hezbollah, considered as hostile to Israel, like Palestinian groups such as the Islamic Jihad or Hamas, or Lebanese groups like the Jemaah Islamiyah. This is in addition to attacking a lot of Lebanese civilians as well and Lebanese infrastructure. So put a lot of pressure on this, as well on Hezbollah and the Lebanese state, creating internal tensions and creating a political fact that make Lebanon, normalizing basically with Israel. Now, what to say on Hezbollah, what should be the position of the left, basically. It's clear, sure, first of all, that there's a right of resistance of any political groups, regardless of our political differences, whether in Palestine, resistance for the Palestinians, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, etc. In Lebanon, it's the same. And to say that, again, as I mentioned before, that despite the ceasefire in November 2024, Israel never stopped its war against the Lebanese population. You had a few hundreds of people assassinated, including civilians, preventing the reconstruction of southern areas. You had kidnappings of Lebanese civilians. You had more than 10,000 violations of Lebanese sovereignty by Israeli occupation army. So this is one thing. So it's to say now, when it comes to Hezbollah's action, despite its rhetoric saying it was acting in defense of Lebanese sovereignty and violation, it was clearly this action of Hezbollah to launch rockets and missile was made because the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is a key support of Hezbollah, whether politically, militarily, financially, which allowed Hezbollah to develop its massive networks of, you know, of institution, to be the second biggest employer in Lebanon, to provide services and social services to large sectors of the Shia population. This wouldn't be possible without Iranian support. So it's launching a missile was part of the Iranian strategy of having multiple fronts against Israel. And Israel used this pretext of this attack to expand this war on Lebanon. And the problem is more deeply that Hezbollah has been more and more isolated in Lebanon because for several reasons. First of all, internally, it has been participating in all Lebanese governments since 2005. So it's part of the ruling class and has led, you know, participated in the country falling in the economic crisis of 2019. It has used its weapon internally against other Lebanese in 2008, for example, you know, invading sectors of Beirut. Moreover, it used its weapons to intervene in Syria on the side of the Assad regime to crush the Syrian uprising, or at least to try to, committing crimes. This increased sectarian tensions within Lebanon. It has opposed the investigation regarding the port explosion. There are many reasons why, you know, Hezbollah has become more and more isolated, and no kind of resistance can be sustained if it is monopolized by one religious sect, one group, and it does not have a political program that sustains democracy, social justice, and equality. It's completely absent. And unfortunately, this weakens any forms of resistance within Lebanon or elsewhere as well. So I think it's saying basically the role of the left is to say right of resistance, denounce the imperialist war, the war led by the Israelis against the Lebanese population, condemned, you know, to the support, especially of Western states, the collaboration of Western states, because this is part of the continuation of the genocide, the support of authoritarian regimes or actors within the region. But at the same time, do not create illusions on Hezbollah, do not politically defend Hezbollah and its policies, and try to support progressive alternatives in Lebanon and in the region more widely. Just as in Iran, we should be opposed to the imperialist war led by the US in Israel, but at no point should we bring any support to the Islamic Republic of Iran that is an authoritarian, despotic regime that is oppressing its people, whether on gender issues, on socioeconomic issues, also against ethnic minorities, religious minorities. And therefore, we would wish the fall of the Iranian regime, but not under Israeli or US bombs, but under the struggles of the popular classes of Iran.
So, of course, the question is where to from here. The US wants a short, sharp war. Iran wants to lengthen, prolong the war for as long as possible. That's their leverage, their power. You know, Australia, for example, is reporting that it only has 30 days of oil left. We know that the International Energy Agency has released 400 million barrels of oil reserves, but from a global perspective, that still is only 26 days of oil. What do you think the trajectory is here? Do we think Iran will get its wish of a prolonged regional war? Do you think the US will find a way to shorten it quickly? I mean, there is a lot they have to surrender in order to shorten the war. What do you think?
I think it's very hard to have a clear answer to this. What is for the moment appearing, or we can imagine, is according to different analysts, an analysis to fall of the Islamic Republic of Iran is nowhere to be seen, even though it's very much weakened. And that usually, generally speaking, we haven't seen the fall of regimes, even authoritarian ones, only with brackets through bombing, with no boots on the ground. There's no structured, organized forces on the ground that can play this role of basically with US assistance, Israel assistance. There have been talks about assisting the Kurds of Iran, different political groups, but how much is this really occurring? There's also hesitation on the Kurdish Iranian side because of what happened, of the history basically of various imperialist forces assisting them before withdrawing and creating consequences that are very negative for the Kurds, as we've just seen recently in Syria, where the US basically supported the PYD, the Kurdish political party, for years in its war against the so-called Islamic State. But for the US, it was always clear that this was a tactical support. And when you have a new government in place in Damascus that is very much pro-US, pro-Gulf monarchy, that is ready to do various concessions to US imperial power, including, you know, normalization with Israel, including, you know, opposing Iran, and for example, deploying its forces at the borders of Lebanon to put pressure on Hezbollah, why would you continue to support, you know, armed non-state entities such as non-state actors such as the Kurds, especially that you want to remain in good relation with one of the biggest actors of NATO, Turkey, which Trump shares very good relation with authoritarian leader Erdogan. To come back to Iran, this I think we, unfortunately, we will have a war that will last at least for the following weeks, because Trump cannot come out of there also without any kind of concessions from the Iranian side, whereas Israel is very happy to continue to create more chaos in the region through its bombings, from its armed actions, whether in Iran, whether in Lebanon, and it has the complete green light of the US to continue this. We also see what's going to be the role and the behavior of Gulf monarchies in the following weeks. Saudi Arabia already said that it would answer militarily if Iran continued to target some of its infrastructures with the oil and others. But what is sure is that the US wanted to last the less, but doesn't have the capacities to obtain the concessions from the Iranian regime. This remains an open question. What is for sure is that the popular classes of the region are suffering from this new war. We can see that also the genocide in Gaza, as we were mentioning, it is continuing, the wide occupation of Palestine, and the willingness of the US-Israel kind of access to really impose its hegemony on the Middle East. So there's still a question remaining on this side. Another key question is what kind of alternative to be built for progressives, what progressive networks, movement to support in the Middle East. And I think here we have a role to play, whether in Iran, whether in Lebanon, to support, you know, basically progressive actors, trade unions, feminist networks, grassroots organization, that want to build this democratic and progressive alternative to both, you know, authoritarian regimes and actors, and oppose as well various international, regional, imperialist powers. First of all, being obviously the US and the settler colonial state, the apartheid state of Israel. Here is the greatest challenge I think the popular classes of the Middle East have for the future.
That was Joe Dahert, academic based in Switzerland. He's also an internationalist, a commentator on politics across the Middle East. A marathon show that brings us to the end of the show. That's it for me, Giselle Hannah.
And me, James Barry.
And coming up next is Palestine Remembered.